Hi, everybody. It is time for your favorite Sun Sounds of Arizona show, Points of View. This is the voice of your volunteer reader, Robert Rosen, and on today's show, we're going to be reading a feature article from the December 2024 issue of The Atlantic Magazine. And this one is headlined, Against Type, How Jimmy O. Yang Became a Main Character. It's by Shirley Lee. Jimmy O. Yang had been trying to make it as an actor for years, cobbling together bit parts in network sitcoms, auditioning for nameless roles such as Chinese Teenager No. 1, when he was cast in a new HBO series. The show Silicon Valley was a comedy about a group of programmers at a Bay Area startup incubator. His character, John Yang, was an app developer who spoke in broken English. It was a small guest role, but he saw it as an opportunity. During his first day on the set, although he had only two lines, he asked Mike Judge, one of the show's creators, whether his character should speak with a Mandarin accent or a Cantonese one. Judge was stumped. I just said, "Oh, well, whichever one's more natural to you." Judge told me, Yang, who'd grown up in Hong Kong, worried that a Cantonese accent was too generic. American viewers might recognize it from Bruce Lee or Jackie Chan movies, because Mandarin is more standard for official and professional context. It can sound more formal, and Yang thought this made more sense for an ambitious immigrant like Yan Yang. Judge told me that he now doesn't remember which accent Yang chose. "I was just glad he was paying that much attention," he said. The show's writer expanded Yang's role, and he eventually became a series regular, reshaping his character into a sly villain whose befuddled exterior disguises an inner ruthlessness. To dampen his performance, Yang developed a mantra, which he would say to himself in Mandarin before every take, "Wu bu zi dao," or "I don't know." He drew his mantra from his own experience dealing with his parents. "Even when I know something and they're like, 'Why is Netflix not working?' I'm like, 'I don't know.'" He grinned at me conspiratorically, "Because I don't care to fix it." "That's how Jin Yang operates too," Yang said. "I think Yin Yang knows that he doesn't really give a shit." And yet, for many viewers, none of this character work mattered. As Silicon Valley grew in popularity, Yin Yang became the subject of scorn for some Asian viewers and critics, who called out the show's writers for peddling a caricature of an Asian immigrant with heavily accented, error-prone English. In 2017, a Wired review called him an example of a toxic Asian stereotype. Yang found these reactions exhausting. "It's like, wow, this is such a big deal for me, and I'm becoming, back in those days, one of the few Asians on TV," he told me. "But you're all going to hate on me?" He felt a familiar anguish. The only roles offered to him were goofy sidekicks and background parts, but even when he tried to make characters like Yin Yang as rounded and complicated as possible, he felt he couldn't win. "I didn't understand the beef against Asian accents," he said. He gets why Asian Americans are sensitive to such portrayals, given Hollywood's long history of stereotyping, but some of the criticism he felt a little overblown and a little dumb. "There was a constant foreigner bit," he explained, referring to the industry's tendency to exoticize Asian characters. "But I was a foreigner." Despite the controversy around the character, Yin Yang ultimately launched Yang's career. In 2018, the year before Silicon Valley ended its run, he appeared on the romantic comedy Crazy Rich Asians, a box office hit now considered a watershed moment for Asian cultural representation. This November, Yang is starring in Hulu's Interior Chinatown, which feels like a different kind of milestone. Adapted from Charles Yu's National Book Award-winning novel of the same name, the series tells the stories of Willis Wu, a background actor on a generic police procedural set in an unnamed city's Chinatown. For Yang, the role is more than a chance to be a leading man. It also uncannily mirrors his own life. Willis is stuck in small, cliched parts, juggling Hollywood's biases and its own ambition, trying to figure out who exactly he wants to be. When Yang first immigrated from Hong Kong to Los Angeles at age 13, the move left him dazed. He was one of a handful of Chinese kids at his school, and he barely spoke English. I was like, "Guys, you're speaking way too fast. I can't," he told me. After 2 years, his mother got a job in Shanghai and left the family behind to return to China, where she stayed for the next decade. Without her, Yang became even more adrift. His father, meanwhile, embraced their new American life. He celebrated their arrival by buying a Pontiac Grand Am. He thought it was so fucking cool because we always had, like, Honda Accords in Hong Kong, Yang told me. Then there was, like, Yang launched into an impression of his dad, puffing out his chest, his voice going gravelly. "American six-cylinder, baby, this is great." Yang worked hard to assimilate in his new surroundings. In Hong Kong, he'd played competitive ping pong and watched kung fu shows on TV. In Los Angeles, he became interested in basketball and football. He fell in love with American television. Bobby Lee on Mad TV, Ken Jeong in Live in Hollywood. He got into hip-hop and tried to build his identity around music, but he still felt like he was faking it. "I wasn't trying to be Asian," he said. "I was trying to be either funnier or catch a football or something so I could fit in." Yang began creating what is now called a locker in his mind, where he hid his former self away so he could make space in my brain to remember American stuff. He compartmentalized so successfully that he's had a weird memory lapse about his pre-California childhood in Hong Kong. When Yang arrived at UC San Diego in 2005, the school student body was 37% Asian, a higher percentage than any other ethnic group. After years of trying to fit in with his Los Angeles classmate, he found it disorienting to suddenly be one among many. "I'm like, I actually want to stand out," he said. "I don't want to be grouped in with all the Asians." He grew his hair long and started skateboarding and smoking weed, anything to avoid seeming like a stereotype. But he also worried about disappointing his parents, both of whom had practical jobs. His father was a financial advisor at Merrill Lynch, and his mother worked in retail. So he pursued an economics degree and interned at a financial consulting firm. Then one summer night before his last year of college, he paid $5 on a whim to do 5 minutes of stand-up on an open mic night in North Hollywood. On stage, he found that joking about his identity somehow alleviated the strain of feeling like an outsider. "They didn't know who I was. I wasn't Jimmy. I was just the next comedian up. This guy who looks Asian," he said. "They didn't come to see me. It was almost like I had to address, like, hey, yeah, I know I'm Asian. This is my experience." Yang was more than willing to lean into stereotypes. His early stand-up included an impression of an Asian guy trying to hit on a girl. "Let me holler at you. Come back. I'll do your nails for you," he'd say in an exaggerated accent. In another bit, he joked about the lack of Asians on the Maury Povich show. "You never see some dude walking down the steps of shame and being like, look, Maury, look, I've got small eyes. He's got one big eye. That's not my baby, Maury." Yang had a relaxed, good-natured stage presence. But these bits were, as he put it, hacky Asian stuff. He was happy to confirm audiences' biases if it made them laugh. Around that time, he started using the handle @funnyasiandude for his social media accounts. To make a living, he worked as a used car salesman during the day and as a strip club at night. The latter combined the salesmanship I learned in the used car business with the microphone skills I learned doing stand-up, he told Conan O'Brien years later. Yang turned down an offer for a cushy finance job against his father's wishes in favor of pursuing open mic nights. He also began auditioning for TV shows and movies, going out for pretty much any casting call that would have him. As he wrote in his 2018 memoir, Loud Japanese Host, Weird Korean Jogger Guy, Video Game Addict. You don't want to be in a box, but at the same time, when you're first starting, it's easier to just be like, hey, I'm an Asian actor. Call me if you need an Asian actor, he said. Even after landing his guest role on Silicon Valley, he put his earnings into a used car that he could drive for Uber to make a little more cash. The months after he finished filming his first season in 2014, HBO offered him a contract to be a series regular. When he got the call, he was killing time on the trolley that rolls through the Grove, an outdoor shopping mall in Los Angeles. He rode the trolley back and forth in disbelief, feeling like the gates opened, like there was finally a real player now in the industry. He called his dad, who said, in Yang's words, oh, okay, so you have an employment contract with HBO, which is a company. Good. Thank God. In person, Yang is a warm and easygoing with an approachable air. One afternoon this summer, we met for lunch at a Thai restaurant in L.A. As soon as he sat down, a woman leaned over and stopped him in mid-sentence. Are you the famous guy? She asked. Probably not, he said. She laughed and held up her phone for a selfie anyway. Yang could have taken offense that the woman seemed to view him as just that vaguely familiar face. He wouldn't have been the first Asian actor to be confused with another one. In his 2020 comedy special on Amazon Prime, Good Deal, he joked about fans who approached him looking anxious. Are you sure that's not Ken Young? He imagines them wondering. But when I brought up the incident the next time we met over dim sum in Monterey Park, he laughed, unbothered. He's accustomed to this particular kind of fame, to being that guy I've seen before. It's a long way from where he started. Since Yang began his career in the early 2010s, opportunities for Asian actors have exploded, a surge that Yang attributes largely to the success of Crazy Rich Asians. In that movie, a young Chinese-American woman goes to Singapore to meet her boyfriend's family and is thrown into the high-flying milieu of Asia's ultra-wealthy. As the playboy Bernard, Yang found a desperate streak beneath his character, Bravado. When the film became a global hit in 2018, it was hailed as proof that Asian-led projects could find commercial success in Hollywood. In 2020, the Korean movie Parasite swept the Oscars. In 2023, Everything, Everywhere, All at Once, led by Yang's Crazy Rich Asians co-star Michelle Yeoh, did the same. A study published by the University of Southern California's Annenberg Inclusion Initiative found that the percentage of Asian characters with speaking parts in top-grossing films each year climbed from roughly 3% in 2007 to nearly 16% in 2022. Asians were the only minority group to see such a big increase in that period. At the same time, more Asian writers and directors were getting the opportunity to create their own work, which gave rise to a range of Asian characters who are delightfully eccentric, but also specific and human. Now there are far fewer roles like the yin-yang of early Silicon Valley, and more roles, say, like Steven Yeun and Ali Wong's deranged obsessive duo in B Beef, the Emmy-winning drama about a road rage incident that escalates into a murderous feud. As Young has also appeared in Crazy Rich Asians and has become a close friend of Yang's, put it to me, there's more diversity in our diversity now. This doesn't mean that choosing roles was suddenly easy for actors like Yang. Not long after Crazy Rich Asians, he got sent a script for a movie about William Hung, who'd become an early viral sensation after an awkward 2004 American Idol audition during which he gyrated and sang Ricky Martin's She Bangs off-key. The writer wanted Yang to play Hung. It was a starring role in a potentially splashy biopic, but Yang turned it down. In June 2020, during an appearance on Joe Rogan's podcast, he told Rogan that the script made him want to fucking vomit. Hung, he said, had set us back 10 years. In response, Hung posted a video addressed to Rogan and Yang. I understand where you might be coming from, because you're not the only person who believes that I portray Asian stereotypes, Hung said. But he added, I believe everyone has a right to try something new without being judged or ridiculed. When I brought up his comments about Hung, Yang grimaced. His objection to the project, he told me, was not about Hung himself, but rather about the way the script missed an opportunity to examine why he'd become famous and how his notoriety had affected the perception of Asian Americans, especially Asian men. People made fun of him, Yang said. He was the butt of the joke, and every one of us was called William Hung in high school for a couple of years. To Yang, the way American Idol portrayed Hung and how the show threw him out there and how America ganged up and laughed at him, that could be the story we're telling. Many Asian performers still find it hard to shake the fear that they'll be turned into a punchline the way Hung was. In hindsight, Yang said of those 2020 comments, I think that was my own frustration, my own insecurity. For Asian actors, living through this cultural sea change, career choices can seem frightened with a new sense of responsibility and occasionally feelings of guilt. I spoke with Young about that what is arguably his most well-known role, the Chinese gangster Mr. Chow in the 2009 comedy The Hangover. To Young, Mr. Chow was puncturing the stereotype because there was not a lot of stereotypes where, you know, an Asian man jumps out naked on Bradley Cooper's shoulder and beats him up. Still, other things about Mr. Chow now seem to give him pause, including his exaggerated accent. I haven't done an accent on live TV since, he told me, and there's a reason for that. When I mentioned this to Yang, he shrugged and sighed. Yeah, yeah, and that's his battle, he said. As much as Yang admires Young, his own view of what makes for good representation seems somewhat different. He doesn't think there's anything inherently wrong with an Asian character who has a thick accent, and doesn't think breaking down stereotypes requires playing a kind of character audiences have never seen before. He'd be interested in a role that seemed like an Asian cliche, like a mathematician, if it surprised him. If there was more interesting angle about the man, or is it just a super one-dimensional? Here's an Asian guy good at math. The question he asks himself about each character now is simple. Is he human? Yang's stand-up comedy has evolved, too. He still riffs on being Asian, but his material is more precise, more personal. In his 2023 special for Amazon Prime, Guess How Much, he jokes about the frugality of his mother, with whom he's grown close again after their long separation. She still loves a bargain. He says her catchphrase is, guess how much? He still plays with stereotypes, but now he has a knack for turning them on their head. Joking about the global rise of K-pop, he says, I had a 15-year-old white kid come up to me trying to explain the different members of BTS. I'm like, dude, they look the same to me. Last year, Yang changed his Instagram handle from @funnyasiandude to just @JimmyOYang. If I log on every day on Instagram, I see funny Asian dude. I'm not saying that to myself over and over again. I'm the only funny Asian, he told me. But I think I'm more than that, and I could be more. In interior Chinatown, Willis lives in a crowded apartment complex and works as a waiter at a restaurant called the Golden Palace while dreaming of becoming a kung fu guy. What Willis doesn't fully understand is that he's actually a background actor, otherwise known as a generic Asian man in a procedural called Black and White, which is occasionally set at the Golden Palace. The show within the show stars a black male detective and a white female detective who flirt and banter with unrelenting cop show swagger. Over time, Willis becomes entangled in the plot of Black and White, landing bigger and bigger roles, and gradually realizing that he's been trapped inside a Hollywood stereotype all along. The first episode opens with Willis witnessing an incident related to a crime that Black and White detectives are investigating. He starts to notice the strangeness of his circumstance, and with the help of a new-to-town cop, he searches for his long-lost brother, a kung fu guy who may know more about what's going on. Charles Yu's novel is structured like a screenplay, with stage directions full of character descriptions and lyrical digressions. Yu, who is also an executive producer, told me that he wrote the book in part to untangle his anxieties about the way cultural depictions of Asian people have influenced his perception of himself. Like, is his face lovable? He said. Do we deserve to be characters, let alone main characters? He wanted the mechanics of Willis's world to reflect Hollywood's now narrow logic about race. The novel is so high concept that adapting it for the screen was a gamble for Hulu. But the series cleverly uses the tools of television to render the layered realities of the book. The lights in the Golden Plaza darken to indicate when Black and White is filming and Willis has entered the world. When Willis goes from being interior Chinatown star to Black and White's genetic Asian man, the show challenges the audience to find him again, somewhere in the background of its shots. And the book's central metaphor has been made usefully concrete. On the day I visited the set of Interior Chinatown, Yang was filming a scene, invented for the show, that required him to repeatedly run into a pair of doors. The doors led to the police precinct, the setting for Black and White's highest-stakes subplots, where generic Asian men like Willis are not allowed. Willis is largely a dramatic role, but there are moments of physical comedy, and Yang was clearly having fun with this one. He improvised different takes. He tailgated a group of people trying to sneak in behind them, blocked. He sided up to the doors as if he could trick the inanimate wooden panels into staying ajar, blocked again. He took a running start, falling straight before he reached the threshold. When Yang first read the scripts for Interior Chinatown, he thought of all the ways in which he'd lived Willis's Wu's life. He looked for jobs as a background actor by calling Central Casting, the same agency that employs Willis. He'd even worked at a restaurant called Chop Suey in Los Angeles, Little Tokyo. But Yang also thought that Interior Chinatowns, with its self-awareness and depth, was a new kind of story. He found a shirt that he'd worn in his 20s when he still worked as a waiter and smeared it with chili oil and put on the scuffed-up Goodwill boots he'd worn back then, too. Then, in a hotel room, he auditioned for Willis over Zoom. In the scene, Yang read the reality-bending mechanics of black and white are absent. Instead, Willis has a difficult conversation with his father, reluctantly admitting that he feels unmoored in life and asking for advice only to get stern replies. At first, Yang had trouble evoking Willis's emotions and worried that he was forcing his tears. Then the episode director, Taika Waititi, stepped in. Waititi urged Yang to think about how Willis's real motivation is to leave the conversation, but stays out of some helpless indistinct in to oblige his father, maybe because he's holding on to the hope that he'd hear what he wants to hear, that his father understands Willis's angst. The note evoked a memory for Yang as a teenager. He struggled to communicate his feelings to his father because when he did, he felt it hard to bottle those feelings back up again. When I was younger, he told me, and I'd ask my dad about my mother, like, why did she move to Shanghai? I couldn't help but start uncontrollably sobbing. Yang realized that Willis's dynamic with his father was the one he knew well. He'd push and pull between wanting to say everything and holding back. The emotional gulf that can stretch between an immigrant father and his more assimilated son. I don't know anyone who embodies better a bunch of the feelings and anxieties and insecurities that are part of why I wrote the book, You Told Me of Yang. And Yang's relationship with his father was once more strained. Lately, that has changed. Richard O. Yang, which has been so encouraged by his son's success that he recently started auditioning for roles himself. Oh Yang told me that Yang now gives him professional advice. Jimmy always asks me to be more serious about acting and take some classes. Oh Yang wrote by email, yet I think I'm too old to learn any new tricks and prefer to be a nepo daddy. In May, father and son did an ad for Toyota together, with O Yang dryly complaining about his son's driving skills as they navigate a snowy wilderness. It was so cute. It was so stoked, Yang said of his father. He posted all over his Chinese social media. Yang has also reconnected with the younger self he'd placed inside that mental locker back in 2000. His childhood comes rushing back at him at certain moments when he smells stuffed fish cakes like the ones he used to eat with his mother at the shop near their Hong Kong apartment, when he's speaking Cantonese, and sometimes when he performs. Playing Willis helped him rediscover, he said, stuff that I've taken for granted and that I've forgotten, the memories of who he was before. And that was Against Type, How Jimmy O. Yang Became a Main Character by Shirley Lee in the Atlantic Magazine, December 2024 issue. And we're about halfway through the show, so let's take a little break here to remind everybody you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this is your favorite Sun Sounds of Arizona show, Points of View. And if you remember that I've been telling you for all this show the whole time, you can go back and listen to this show from the top, or you can go back and listen to a few weeks past on this show simply by downloading the Sun Sounds of Arizona app on your phone or on your tablet. And in there you can stream or download the feeds that are coming from Sun Sounds of Arizona, from Tempe, from Flagstaff or Tucson. And if you scroll down a little bit, you'll go down and see all the shows that are broadcast, and you will find the show Points of View in the entertainment section. And let's continue on. I have another article here, and it is headlined, Nick Cave Wants to Be Good. I was just a nasty little guy. And it is in the December 2024 issue of The Atlantic Magazine, and it is by Spencer Kornhaber. Nick Cave, one of the most physically expressive figures in rock and roll, was looking at me with suspicion. His eyebrows climbed the considerable expanse of his forehead. his slender frame tense defensively in his pinstripe suit. I think he thought I was trying to get him canceled. What I was really trying to do is get him to talk about being a man. For much of his four-decade career fronting Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, Cave has seemed a bit like a drag king, exaggerating aspects of his male id to amusing and testifying effect. He performs in formal wear, sings in a growl that evokes Elvis with rabies, and writes acclaimed songs and books brimming with lust, violence, and in recent years, as he weathered the death of two sons, pained fatherly gravitas. His venerated stature is more akin to a knighted icon than a punk rocker's. He has been awarded a badge of honor by the Australian government and a fellowship in the United Kingdom's Royal Society of Literature, and was even invited to King Charles' coronation in 2023. So when I met the 67-year-old Cave at a Manhattan hotel in August, before the release of the Bad Seeds' 18th studio album, Wild God, I suspected that I might not be alone in wanting to hear his thoughts about the state of masculinity. Meaning, why are guys, according to various cultural and statistical indicators, becoming lonelier and more politically extreme? I cited some lyrics from his new album that seemed to be about the way men cope with feelings and insecurity and irrelevance, hoping he would elaborate. Between the long pauses in Cave's reply, I could hear the crinkling leather of the oversized chair he sat in. It may be a need that men have. Maybe they're not feeling like they are valued, he told me, before cutting himself off. I don't want to come on like Jordan Peterson or something, he said, referring to the controversial right-leaning psychology professor and podcaster who rails against the alleged emasculating effects of modern culture. Cave seemed taken aback by the idea that he himself was an authority on the subject. It feels weird to think that I might be tapping into, or somehow the voice of, what it means to be a man in this world, he told me. I've never really seen that. In fact, he said, his songs, especially the recent ones, are very feminine in their nature. I'm criticized for it, actually, he went on. Fans write to him and say, what happened to your fucking music? Grow a pair of balls, you bastard. When Cave was 12, growing up in a rural Australian village, his father sat him down and asked him what he had done for humanity. The young Cave was mystified by the question, but his father, an English teacher with novelist ambitions, clearly wanted to pass along a drive to seek greatness, preferably through literary means. Other dads read The Hardy Boys to their kids. Cave regaled with him with Dostoevsky, Titus, and Lolita. These words, linguistic elegance and thematic savagery, lodged deep in Cave. But music became the medium that spoke best to the emerging point of view, that of an outsider, a bad seed, alienated from ordinary society. When he was 13, a schoolmate's parents accused him of attempted rape after he tried to pull down their daughter's underwear. At the school he was transferred to, he became notorious for brawling with other boys. His father's death in a car crash when Cave was 19 and his own heroin habit at the time didn't help his outlook. I was just a nasty little guy, he told Stephen Colbert recently. His thrashing, split-flinging band at the birthday party earned him comparisons to Iggy Pop, but it wasn't until he formed the Bad Seeds in the early 80s that his bleak artistic vision ripened, blending blues, industrial rock, and cabaret into thunderous musical narratives. The Bad Seeds song felt like retellings of primal fables, often warning about the mortal dangers posed by intimacy, Vulnerability, and Pretty Girls. On the 1984 track, From Here to Eternity, piano chords stabbed like emergency sirens as Cave moaned. This desire to possess her is a wound. Its final stanza implied that Cave's narrator had killed the object of his fascination, a typically grisly outcome in Cave's early songs. His defining classic, 1988's The Mercy Seat, strapped the listener into the position of a man on death row. It plumbed another of Cave's central themes, annihilating shame, the feeling of being judged, monstrous, and fearing the judgment to be true. As Cave aged and became a father to four sons by three different women, his vantage widened. The Bad Seeds 1997 album, The Boatman's Call, a collection of stark love songs inspired by his breakup with the singer PJ Harvey, brought him new fans by recasting him as a romantic tragedian. More and more, the libidinal tone of his work seems satirical. He formed a garage rock band, Grinderman, whose 2007 single, No Pussy Blues, was a send-up of the mindset of those now called incels, construing sexual frustration as cosmic injustice. Cave spat, "I sent her every type of flower. I played a guitar by the hour. I patted her revolting little chihuahua, but still she just didn't want to." In his sensationally filthy 2009 novel, The Death of Bunny Monroe, he set out to illustrate the radical feminist Valery Solana's appraisal that the male completely egocentric trapped himself inside, incapable of empathizing or identifying with others. The actor Matt Smith would soon play the novel's protagonist, an invertebrate pervert in a TV adaptation. But the Cave of today feels far more removed from the theatrical grossness of his past, owing to personal horrors. In 2015, his 15-year-old son, Arthur, fell off a cliff while reportedly on LSD. In 2022, another son, Jethro, died at 31 after struggles with mental health and addiction. "I've had personally enough violence," Cave told me. The murder ballads he once wrote were an indulgence of someone that has yet to experience the ramification of what violence actually has upon a person. "If I'm looking at the death of my children as violent acts, which they are to some degree." Music beckoned as a means of healing. The Bad Seeds 2019 album, Ghost Teen, was a shivery, synth-driven tone poem in which Cave tried to commune with his lost son in the afterlife. By acclamation, it's his masterpiece. Wild God marks another sonic and temperamental reset. Its music is a luminous fusion of gospel and piano pop, more U2 than Stooges, more New Testament than old. Compared with his earlier work, these albums have a more fluid, more watery sort of feel, he said. Which, it's dangerous territory here, but I guess you could feel a feminine trait. On a deeper level than sound, Cave explained, his recent music is feminine because of its viewpoint. His lyrics now account not just for his own feelings, but for those of his wife Susie, the mother of Arthur, and his twin brother Earl. In the first song on Ghost Teen, for example, a woman is sitting in a kitchen listening to music on the radio, which is exactly what Susie was doing when she learned what had happened to Arthur. "After my son died, I had no understanding of what was going on with me at all," Cave said. "But I could see Susie. I could see this sort of drama playing out in front of me." Drama. That sounds disparaging, but I don't mean that. It felt like I was trying to understand what was happening to a mother who had lost her child. Her own subjectivity became hopelessly and beautifully entangled with hers. On Ghosteen, it was very difficult to have a clean understanding of whose voice I actually was in some of these songs. The merging of perspectives reflects more than just shared experiences of suffering. It is part of what Cave sees as a transformation of his worldview, from inward looking to outward looking, from misanthrope to humanist. Arthur's death made him realize that he was part of a universal experience of loss, which in turn meant that he was part of the social whole. Whereas he was once motivated to make art to impress and shock the world, he had now wanted to help people, to transmute gnawing guilt into something good. I felt like, as a father, he was my responsibility and I looked away at the wrong time, that I wasn't sufficiently vigilant, he said in the 2022 interview collection, Faith, Hope, and Carnage. He added, speaking of his and Susie's creative output, there is not a song or a word or a stitch of thread that is not asking for forgiveness. That is not saying that we are just so sorry. On the Red Hand Files, the expository blog that Cave started in 2018, he replies to the question from the public concerning all manner of subjects. How he feels about religion, he doesn't identify as Christian, yet he attends church every week. What he thinks of cancel culture, against it, mercy's antithesis. Whether he likes raisins, they have a grim, scrotal horribleness, but all things, like all things in this world, you, me, and every other thing, they have their place. At least a quarter of the messages he receives from readers expresses one idea. The world is shit, as he put it. That has a sort of range, from people just see everything is corrupt from a political point of view, to people that just see no value in themselves, in human beings, or the world. Cave recognizes that outlook from his Nasty Little Guy days, but he fears that nihilism has moved from the punk fringe to the mainstream. The misery in the inbox reflects a culture that is anti-sacred, secular by nature, unmysterious, unnuanced, he says. He thinks music and faith offer much-needed medicine, helping to re-enchant reality. Cave has been heartened to see so many people evidently feeling the same way. Back when Jordan Peterson was first making his mark as a public figure, Cave devoured his lectures about the Bible, he told me. They were seriously beautiful things. I heard reports about people in his classes. It was like being on acid or something like that. Just listening to this man speak about those sorts of things. It was so deeply complex, and putting the idea of religion back in on the table as a legitimate intellectual concern. But over time, he lost interest in Peterson as he watched him get swept up in the internet's endless polarized culture wars. Twitter in particular, he said, has a terrible diminishing effect on some great minds. The artist's job, as Cave has come to see it, is to work against the erosion of ambiguity and complication, using their creative powers to push beyond reductive binaries, whether they're applied to politics, gender, or the soul. I'm evangelical about the transcendent nature of music itself, he said. We can listen to some deeply flawed individuals create the most beautiful things imaginable. The distance from what they are as human beings and what they're capable of producing can be extraordinary. Music, he added, can redeem the individual. The redemptive spirit hums throughout Wild God. One song tells of a ghostly boy sitting at the foot of the narrator's bed, delivering a message. We all had too much sorrow. Now is the time for joy. The album joins in that call with a surging, uplifting sound. The final track, As Waters Cover the Sea is a straightforward hymn suitable to be sung from the pews of even the most traditional congregation. But the album is not entirely a departure from Cave's old work. He has not fully evolved from living shit post to Hallmark card, as he once joked in a Red Hand Files entry. Frogs begins with a stark reference to the tale of Cain and Abel, ushering in the week he knelt down, crushed his brother's head with a bone, and builds to Cave singing in ecstatic tones, "Kill me." His point is that joy is not happiness. It's not a simple emotion, he told me. Joy in its way is a form of suffering in itself. It's rising out of an understanding of the base nature of our lives into an explosion of something beautiful and then kind of retreat. A few songs portray an old man, or seemingly interchangeably an old god or a wild god, on a hallucinatory journey around the globe, lifting the spirits of the downtrodden wherever he goes. At times, the man comes off like a deluded hero, or even a problematic one. It was rape and pillage in the retirement village, but in his mind, he was a man of great virtue and courage. Cave sings on the album's title track. In Cave's view, though, this figure is a deeply sympathetic character, he told me, a person who feels separated from the world and is looking for someone that will see him of some value. As with Ghostine, the album mixes Susie's perspective with Cave's. One song, Conversion, was inspired by an experience, or maybe a vision, that she had, and that she asked her husband not to publicly disclose in detail. There is some gentle tension between my wife, who's an extremely private person, and my own role, which is someone that pretty much speaks about pretty much everything, Cave said. In the song, the old god shambles around a town whose inhabitants watch him, with looks on their faces worse than the grief itself. Perhaps pity, perhaps judgment. Then he sees a girl with long dark hair. They embrace. They erupt into a cleansing flame, curing the man of his pain. As Cave described this moment in the song to me, he flared his eyes and made an explosive noise with his mouth. In my mind, I could see the old god. He looked just like Cave. And that was Nick Cave Wants to Be Good by Spencer Kornhaber, in the December 2024 issue of The Atlantic magazine. And we have time for another short article here. This one is headlined, "The Weirdest Hit in History, How Handel's Messiah Became Western Music's First Classic," by Jan Swafford, from the December 2024 issue of The Atlantic magazine. Among the pedestal titans of Western music, George Frederick Handel was the first composer whose work not only quickly became celebrated in its own time, but has been heralded ever since. Before Handel, no real repertoire of enduring music had existed. Composers were considered craftsmen in an evanescent art, their creations regularly superseded by fresher work. Most music that got performed was relatively new. Claudio Monteverdi, the preeminent European composer of the early 17th century, was largely forgotten within decades of his death. In 1643, Johann Sebastian Bach amounted to hardly more than a cult figure after he died. In 1750, his major works unplayed well into the next century. When Handel died at 74 in 1759, he was already well fortified for posterity. A celebrity since his 20s, he had been the subject of great portraits and was depicted as Orpheus in a 1738 statue in London's Vauxhall Hall Gardens. Whereas Bach earned an unmarked grave in Leipzig and one obituary 4 years after he died, Handel was buried in Westminster Abbey. Handel stands apart in another way from the musical giants who have since been rediscovered and enshrined. Each of them is renowned for an array of often performed pieces. His stature is owed much to all to a single work, the Oratorio Messiah. Among the towering masterpieces of Western music, the Messiah occupies a distinctive place. It is familiar to more people than any other work of its kind. Bach's B minor Mass and St. Matthew's Passion and Monteverde's Vespers are comparable among supreme choral pieces, but they aren't performed at your church or your high school down the street. The Messiah often is trotted out during Christmas season by amateur and professional choruses around the globe. A fair percentage of the world probably knows the Hallelujah Chorus well enough to sing along. The skewed acclaim is unfair to Handel, who was brilliantly prolific as any composer who ever lived, but is also a tribute to the overwhelming effect of the Messiah, which is a feat of sustained inspiration, arguably unsurpassed in the canon of Western classical music. Comfort ye, my people, the libretto suggests, pulling us in at the beginning, its flow of compelling melody and stirring choruses enthralling us for the next 2 hours and leaving us singularly exalted. Reasons for the Messiah's enduring power are manifold, though certainly they begin with the music itself, which manages to join the lofty and the populist, as does all of Handel's work. King, a professor of international affairs and government at Georgetown University and a splendid writer, has made a specialty of popular cultural history. A meticulous researcher, he delivers surprises, and his prologue is one of them. For example, King delves at the length at the outlandish martial trivials of the Susanna Sibler, whom Handel turned to as he rounded up singers for the Messiah premiere in 1742 in Dublin, a preposterous conversions for both. We learn, as a scandalized public did, all from her husband's outrageous abusiveness, her lover's and family's effort to protect her, and two lawsuits her husband filed against her lover. Seibert's well-known suffering lent her music lamentations in the oratorio a raw power. He was despised and rejected of men, she sang, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief for a stunned opening night audience and in many of the performances afterwards. Among the possibly apotypical stories about Handel, one has him commenting to his servant upon finishing the Hallelujah Chorus. I did think I did see all of heaven before me and the great God himself seated on his throne. Yet he was eager to share an awestruck response to the Dublin premiere. As King reports, Handel wrote a letter a few months after the event, enclosing an Irish bishop's verdict. The whole is beyond anything I had notion of till I read and heard it, the cleric reported. It seems to be a species of music different from any other. The letter was to Jennings, the Messiah's lyricist. Handel wanted to know how well your Messiah was received in your country. One most inspired composers of the time might have been aware, in some sense, that he had transcended himself, but he could not claim to understand the alchemy which had worked this wonder. In the spirit of his oratorio, the goal of his letter seems to have been not to blow his own horn, but to give comfort to his companion in the endeavor. And that was The Weirdest Hit in History, How Handel's Messiah Became Western Music's First Classic, by Jan Swafford in the Atlantic, December 2024 issue. And that will bring us to the end of another Points of View. It's been a pleasure reading for you. This is the voice of your volunteer reader, Robert Rosen, and we will talk to you next week.